Hi, this is Leonard Lopate. You're listening to WNYC On Demand. Podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads available when you want to listen at WNYC.org and iTunes.
WNYC On Demand is supported by DataPipe Managed Hosting Services, providing application management, hosting, professional services, security services, and compliance solutions for mid-market and Fortune 1000 enterprises. DataPipe.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
There's a strong film preservation movement in this country determined to restore the key movies of the past, but countless works of more dubious lineage, the so-called orphan films, are often abandoned or ignored. Not by Dan Strebel, however. He's the director of the Orphan Film Symposium, and he'll be presenting a best-of symposium tonight at 8 o'clock at the IFC Center on 6th Avenue across from Waverly Place, what used to be the Waverly Theater. Mm-hmm. It's part of the Stranger Than Fiction series, and I'm very pleased he could join me today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So how would you describe an orphan film?
I always say there are kind of two definitions. One, there is a strict legal definition.
There's really a legal definition?
It has legal implications, I guess, but it involves copyright. Mm-hmm. And so the term was coined by people in archives and preservation to describe these films they had lying around, but they could not identify the owners of or could not locate the owners. And so they couldn't invest any money in preserving the film for fear that someone would come out and claim it. So copyright law is being reformed a bit and might be reformed more still to make room for what are more broadly called orphan works.
And put them into the public domain?
It depends. Usually that would be what would happen. If a museum or a library or an archive finds a film, can identify an owner, does the restoration work, then it would not be under copyright anymore.
Well, it would be a rather tragic thing if somebody spent a lot of money to preserve a film and then suddenly along comes MGM and says, hey, wait a minute, I own this.
Yeah, it's happened before. But I use the term more liberally, as do all the people who attend this symposium on a biannual basis, and that is just to kind of embrace and champion things which have been neglected in any form, now, whether it's physical deterioration or cultural neglect or censored or whatever the category is.
I would assume many of them were simply ignored because they weren't made with famous stars or with top directors, reasons that people might pay more attention to them.
Right. And I would say even more than that, it's the fact that many of these are not completed works. It might be extraordinary, you know, documentation. For example, Newsreel Archive, Fox Movie Tone News, we found this negative that had never been printed, therefore no one had ever watched it. And it was about 8 minutes of a synchronous sound recording of a truck driving down Radio Row in New York in 1929, recording the live sound.
Which is where the World Trade Center?
Yeah, Cortland. And as the truck drove by, every radio store was wafting out a different recording, and there was opera mixing with, you know, jazz music, and everyone on the street was just awestruck in silence looking up at the camera. And then there was this kind of almost montage intelligence with steam shovels and elevated trains and the sounds of the city and horns intermixing with horse hooves. It was really a remarkable film, but no one, we wouldn't think of it as a movie, but just as a piece of history that needs to be preserved. It's really amazing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it can be incorporated into a film.
Absolutely, yeah.
And is that what happens to a lot of these? Because many of them are instructional films, aren't mm-hmm. they? Often presented as camp when they are fully preserved.
Yeah, oftentimes I think we've all experienced the older something gets, the more distant and therefore potentially funny it might become. Although we also, I think, are finding that a lot of this stuff actually does hold up well, and it's kind of the best of that we try to bring to the surface. But you're right, it does involve not just film preservation and researchers. We involve filmmakers equally, mostly people who work with archival material or so-called found footage. So they're a big part of this movement as well.
How much footage are we talking about here? I'm assuming there's an awful lot of this stuff floating around.
Mm-hmm. Well, Martin Scorsese's Film Foundation sometimes uses the very round figure of 100 million feet of 35 millimeter film.
And then there's got to be 8 and 16
as
well.
Yeah, and with 8 and 16, you know, there's far more of that material shot than all of the feature films in Hollywood, you know, laid end to end, just in terms of footage and running time. So I would say that the majority of films ever made no longer exist. And those that do exist, 90% of those are not accessible or distributed.
How did you get into this whole thing?
I was trained as a film historian, and I was teaching mostly American film history and early cinema, had done a lot of archival research, when a library at the University of South Carolina asked me to put together a one-off film preservation symposium to highlight their collection. And I just invited, you know, the people who I knew and respected in the field, and they all said yes. They all came, and it just kind of grew from there, and every year it's gotten bigger.
So you've been doing symposia every year or more than one?
We started out doing them every 18 months or so, but now we're in definitely a biennial. So we'll do them in even-numbered years. And this is the first one to be in New York. I now teach at New York University.
And I'm assuming that film buffs are all fascinated by this.
Yeah,
But also historians?
Yeah. What's hard to describe about this thing we call the Orphan Film Symposium, it's kind of like somewhere between a festival and a conference. There are lots of films shown. Many of them are premieres of things which have been newly discovered or newly restored. But every film tends to need quite a bit of setup and explanation about what it is you're going to see and where it came from. And with that information, the films become much more pleasurable and enriching to watch. But it's not a festival in the sense that you buy a ticket and you go sit down for 2 hours and be entertained. But it has that kind of spirit, and people have a good time, and we take all our meals together for 4 days, and it becomes a real kind of 300 people bonding around the same love for obscure films.
What can you tell us about the obscure films? One of the ones you'll be showing tonight, Teenage Cosmonauts.
Yes.
1979.
Right. This turned up 2006. New York University Library acquired the collection of the Communist Party of the United States of America. And in that vast collection was a lot of audiovisual material, several hundred films. And this is one of those films. It's a 16-millimeter print in English, so it obviously was made for English language distribution by the Soviets. Don't know where the original would be. There's a 35-millimeter original somewhere, if it's still around. It's probably in one of the huge vaults of Moscow or somewhere else.
Is it a propaganda film?
It is definitely a propaganda film, and it's very similar to the kind of, you know, teenage astronauts theme we would have seen in the United States in the 1970s. Aimed at just kind of celebrating the school for training cosmonauts that the youth of the Soviet Union in 1979 had available to them, the Gagarin School of for cosmonauts. So it's a short film. You know, it's hard to say. No one's really researched, you know, where it was shown or how it might have been received where it was shown, but it came to our light because of this Communist Party collection.
And I would assume its appeal is as a piece of exotica.
To some degree, that's there. But what's also interesting is, having watched not a lot, but a few of these films from the Russian and other communist propaganda outlets in the 60s and 70s, is how much they actually do also work as kind of a time capsule of what life was like in those places at that time. You know, most people in the United States have headfuls of stereotypes of the way it was depicted to us during the Cold War. So it's always interesting to see how the other side of the Cold War was depicting themselves.
Well, we have a clip. Should we listen to a little bit?
Yeah.
Enrollment in the Gagarin Young Cosmonaut School.
Why do you want to be a cosmonaut? After graduating from this school, I want to be a pilot. And why do you want to be a cosmonaut? I want to dedicate my life to the cosmos and become a member of the women's team of cosmonauts. How many women cosmonauts are there? Only two so far. And you most likely want to be the third, of course.
Give you the flavor of what it's like. And most of it is monotonous narration by that guy.
Well, that guy should not look for a career in radio, that's for sure. How much does it cost to restore a typical film?
Boy, it varies so widely depending on what kind of needs it has. And usually in the circle of laboratories and archives, they make a very strong distinction between preservation and restoration. Most of the work that we see and that goes on through the Orphan Film Symposium is simply finding material that's on kind of unstable film and copying it to new film, just a straight preservation of the material. The restoration is what the public probably thinks of as the sexy side of taking a Hollywood film and cleaning up the soundtrack and filling in the scratches and so on. And that's at least three times the cost. So probably something like $10,000 to preserve a feature-length film, and then spend as much as you want to alter and enhance it if you really want to.
For Lawrence of Arabia. So
yeah, that kind of thing.
Well, since film is such a money-driven medium, who actually gets any money earned once an orphan film has been restored and is being shown?
They're generally not money makers. These are the nonprofit world of archives, libraries, museums, schools that do this work and that make the material available as a research resource, as educational tools, as cultural heritage artifacts. So really that's another definition some people use of orphan film, is that those films that have survived that have no commercial value, or at least not any obvious value. There are stock footage houses and so on that might be able to milk something of it. But for the most part, this is a time-intensive, capital-intensive labor that happens, and no money kind of comes from it.
That if people can't make it to the symposium at the IFC, are these films available through other sources?
Many of them become available after they're seen here. For example, last year, one of the members of our community, I would say a filmmaker, Helen Hill, was killed in New Orleans, very tragic circumstances. But all of her films, which had survived Hurricane Katrina floods, have now been preserved through the collaboration consortium. Those are all now available for anyone that wants to rent them from Harvard Film Archive.
What kinds of films did she do?
She did short animated and experimental films, very loving, funny, musical things. And there'll be a DVD out soon of a compilation of 10 of her works. That's one example. Another is this film that the Film Foundation, Scorsese's foundation, paid to have preserved for this year's Orphan Film Symposium. It's a fairly obscure short documentary shot in Washington Square Park in 1961, and it's called simply Sunday. It's never been distributed beyond, 1961 when it was thrown on the festival circuit briefly. I imagine that this will then become, part of someone's DVD release or a supplementary material. Scorsese is a big fan of the film, and Dan Drayson, the filmmaker, is still very much alive. He made a film when he was 19 years old, and it's about folk singers rioting against police in Washington Square Park.
So I would assume in some cases it's because a filmmaker like Dan Drayson makes it available, or you know who Helen Hill is, but mm-hmm. in others it's because somebody rummaged through a closet and found stuff.
Yeah, literally that's often the case. Like tonight, one of the things people could see if they come to the IFC Center show is a 15-minute film which a New York filmmaker, Jeannie Liotta, found literally on the curb. And we wound up watching it at Anthology one day during what was called Home Movie Day. No one knew what was on the reel. It turned out to be a wedding film, very beautifully shot. And it also happened to be the wedding film of the famous boxer Jose Torres.
Oh, yeah, and it made the newspapers.
Right, yeah, the New Yorker did a write-up. And, so the couple had lost their own wedding film and hadn't had it for like 40 years.
The Home Movie Day is at the Anthology Film Archives in the East Village.
Yes, it was August last year. Now it's going to be every October. There'll be a Home Movie Day internationally where every venue that wants to participate invites the public in to show their 8, Super 8, and 16 films.
Some of these old movies must be pretty fragile. Isn't there a danger of showing them on movie house projectors?
There is a danger, but it's archivists who put on these events. So they inspect the films beforehand, and if there is any kind of damage or possibility of damage in a projector, they won't show it. But they can generally tell when it's fit to run, and they use only the kind of very gentlest projectors available. So there's people that know what they're doing. I've seen more than 100 films projected in two or three different cities. I've never seen a film damaged.
Because I used to go to the movies all the time, the Lowe's Commodore in Williamsburg, and invariably at some point the film would start burning and we'd be yelling at the projectionist.
Yeah.
Has the Library of Congress gotten into the orphan film world? Any of them landmarked?
They have. A couple of films which were first seen through the symposium or chosen by the symposium have made it to the Librarian's National Film Registry that gets announced every year. So this year we're actually premiering at the symposium two of those works. One is a extraordinary home movie shot throughout the 1960s by a father who had a son with Down syndrome, and the kind of sequence of events ends with him giving the son up to an institution. So it's a very sad story, but he years later went and edited that footage together and put a spoken narration on it, a kind of poetic love letter to his son. And that just turned up actually at a home movie day event that Helen Hill organized in New Orleans the year after Katrina, and everyone was just stunned by this work. So it's now been, for the first time ever, the film and the soundtrack have been married, and it's been put on 35 millimeter by Haga Film in Amsterdam. And the other film from the National Film Registry that turned up at a home movie day this year was another jaw-dropping experience for me. A woman who lives in Brooklyn came and said, this is a film my father made in 1938, and it was a short little edited story film with intertitles and everything. But boy, it looked like it was shot by Orson Welles or Greg Toland or something. He was just an exquisite cinematographer with a 16-millimeter camera. And so here's this beautiful movie. It's still a very entertaining and aesthetically pleasing experience to watch, but it was made in a small town in Kentucky in the Depression. That's not what we think of coming out of that culture, but yet here it is. So the surprises never cease to amaze me. So that film's now been preserved and blown up to 35 for distribution as well.
These days, there are films that are actually made to go straight to DVD. In the old days, they just would be kept in the vaults. Mm-hmm. Would they also be orphan films? There's a listener wants to know about a film called Lolly Madonna, which was made in the 70s with Rod Steiger and Jeff Bridges and was never released in any format. Would that be called an orphan film?
Yeah, in fact, that's in the industry, that's what the orphan film term means, is an undistributed film.
And there must be any number in Hollywood vaults.
Yeah, absolutely. Or in other vaults, or oftentimes I wind up in the hands of private collectors who manage to get them out of the vaults with no one looking. So you never know where they're going to turn up. They turn up in odd places as well as in these traditional film vaults, where almost every film vault in the world is full of material that's just not been identified.
Now, you have a book coming out from the University of California Press in April called Fight Pictures.
Yes.
Those are the movies that they used to show as part of the double features, the stuff in between in the old days?
Part of the big fight? So. Yeah. It starts from the very beginning of cinema, and most of the book is about the first 30 years or so of film history, silent period, but also goes into the 30s as well. But it was a phenomenon. As soon as cinema was born, one of the first massively commercially successful genres were recordings of prize fights, and then there were reenactments, films to try to exploit that market. So there are all kinds of weird and crazy variations on the theme, but it was the law of the land from 1912 until 1940 that those films were illegal to distribute in the United States because there was a reaction against Jack Johnson as the first black heavyweight, and white racists and others just couldn't have these feature-length films showing in theaters all over the country.
Then King Joe Louis came along,
yeah.
And that made it even rougher, I'm
yeah.
sure.
But what's interesting is we've seen Joe Louis fight on film many times, but at the time those films were being shot in Madison Square Garden and Yankee Stadium, it was illegal to take them outside of New York State. But, of course, they got taken outside of New York State and were seen everywhere. But it was a violation of federal law, and the feds never were able to tame that market.
We're going to go out with a little clip from something else you'll be screening tonight. Something called The School at Rincon Santo from 1963. What is this?
Yeah, this is a 10-minute film. It's one of three 10-minute films directed by James Blue, who was a really extraordinary, not quite experimental, but an innovative documentarian.
He didn't make Blue films.
He did not make Blue films, which I can't say that. I don't know all of his
output.
Would
they be called orphan films?
They're orphaned in one sense that I think is very important in addition to the, needing preservation. George Stevens Jr., when he was head of the U.S. Information Agency's film division, he hired a lot of these young creative directors like James Blue and, had them go out and shoot films which were at the service of American foreign policy or whatever. So this, The School at Rincon Santo, is one of three films he made, all shot in the nation of Colombia in 1963, and they were all to promote Kennedy's new Alliance for Progress. That's the story of it. And they're orphaned in the sense that until 1990, it was literally illegal to show these films in the United States. They could only be seen outside of the United States.
Thank you so much, Dan Strebel, for talking with us.
Thank you.
This is a part of the spirit of the Alliance for Progress. People helping themselves. And the success of the Alliance for Progress is to be found in just such simple things as the new school at Rincon Santo.
Oh, glory, marcesible, oh, júbilo inmortal, en surcos de dolores, el bien germina ya.
Thanks for listening to WNYC On Demand. Please check out the other programs at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This is a free service made available by our listeners. Become a member of WNYC today.